From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. The fabled Mekong River has long been a fount of commerce, communication, and conflict in Southeast Asia. From its headwaters in Tibet, the river flows through six countries on its way to the South China Sea. This week, NPR's Southeast Asia correspondent Michael Sullivan travels the river to find out how the people and cultures along its banks are coping in the modern world. In the first of a five-part series, he begins high on the Tibetan Plateau in the mountains of China's Qinghai province.
It's a long way to the source of the Mekong, a three-day journey by four-wheel drive from the nearest airport in Xining. Then another day on horseback, but early on, I met some travelers whose journey made mine seem easy. Step, step, slide. Step, step, slide. Two young Buddhist monks on a pilgrimage to the Tibetan city of Lhasa. They will walk and slide, their chests protected by leather aprons, all the way as they fling themselves to the pavement and closer to their goal. It's more than 400 miles from their monastery to Lhasa. Their journey, one says, will take 6 months. He says it will be hard but worth it, a chance to pray at the Jokong Temple in Lhasa and accumulate merit and good karma along the way. This makes perfect sense to my Tibetan colleagues who are also looking for good karma, or at least a little help on our journey. And they ask for it regularly at the high mountain passes on our way. The passes are draped in brightly colored prayer flags left by previous travelers. The shouting, the guide explains, an offering both to God and the local mountain deities to protect us on our journey. A little luck doesn't hurt on this highway, where landslides or avalanches can cut the road for days, even weeks. The Tibetan Plateau is the source of almost all Asia's great rivers, the Yangtze, the Ganges, and the Mekong among them, and one of the world's largest sources of fresh water. This area was occupied by the Chinese some 60 years ago. But they stick mainly to the towns, the countryside, still the domain of Tibetan nomads. We go off-road, upriver, 3 days into our journey, traveling along the rocky bed of the Mekong, here a glacial stream the Tibetans know as the Zatchu. It's clear, icy cold, and sweet. Our destination for the evening, a small mud-walled shack on a bluff overlooking the river, where a trio of Tibetan mastiffs demand to know why we're here. Our host, Sonam Yapal, spends the harsh Tibetan winters here with his yaks and his family. He says he gets to the nearest town maybe twice a year to sell yak butter and cheese. The family burns dried yak dung for heat, but has a solar-powered TV and DVD player, the panel, he says, a gift from the Chinese government. A government that would probably be less than happy if they saw the picture of Tibet's exiled spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, on the wall. The next morning, our host lends us a few horses for the final push to the source. Sure-footed and even-tempered, they pick their way carefully through the icy river and boggy terrain. Yesterday, we spotted a pack of wolves loping alongside the river. Today, it's mountain gazelle, eagles, and wild donkeys. My guide, a Tibetan country boy who now lives in the city and doesn't get out nearly enough, surprises me when he starts singing as we ride. I gotta be honest, this kind of thing is usually embarrassing, but not this time. And when I ask him why he's singing, he just laughs, as if I'm the idiot. And of course he's right. He's Tibetan, he's on a horse, in the mountains, far from anyone or anything that could bother him. Why wouldn't he be singing? His mood changes, though, when we talk about the Chinese government's efforts to rein in the nomads, to fence in their traditional grazing areas and resettle them in towns. The government says it's an effort to avoid environmental degradation. The Tibetans see it as another attempt by the Chinese to wipe out their traditions and their culture. The weather turns abruptly, the sun disappears, the snow starts, and I start to worry. But by early afternoon, we finally reach our destination in a near whiteout, a tiny marker and an even tinier trickle coming from the rock more than 3 miles above sea level, some 3,000 miles from where the Mekong finally empties into the South China Sea.
Now we're at the real source of the Mekong River. So in Chinese, called Lanzangjiang, it means Mekong River. And in Tibetan, we call it Zachu. And this is the original source. There we can see the tiny stream coming under the rock. And this is the real source of the Mekong River, I think.
Now, the Chinese government says this is the real source, but Tibetans believe otherwise.
Yeah, Tibetans believe the other source to the south. It's about 30 kilometers. And the place called Dashichua, that's the source that Tibetans believe.
Either way, this source and the other source meet.
Yeah.
And when they meet, they form the river that we know as the Zachu.
Yeah.
And does this river have any spiritual significance for Tibetans, who are a very spiritual people and who are very close to the earth in general?
Yeah, as I'm a Tibetan, I believe that there are some kind of spirit we call Nagas, spirits of the water, the sea. And these are Nagas, we call Nagas. So when we are kids, we are told by our parents that if you do anything to the spring or to the river, and Nagas will pay you back, like make you sick or, you know, bad fortune or bad luck.
Some Tibetans say that bad luck has come already to the river at the town named for the river some 40 miles to the south and east. A decade ago, Zato was a frontier outpost of single-story buildings and a few shops. Today it's a boomtown. Apartment blocks and businesses sprouting like weeds in the shadow of the mountains and the stupa on the hill. These workers are building a new entertainment complex, complete with cinema and internet cafe, on the southern bank of the multicolored river. Raw sewage flows into the Zachu or Mekong directly across from us near a small mountain of trash, and all of this is too much for one longtime resident here who doesn't want to give his name.
All the sewage from the town, from the hospital, from the restaurants, from the houses, everything gets thrown into the river. And it's not just the Chinese doing it. It's young Tibetans too. All they care about is making money.
Just a few miles downriver, a small hydropower station has been built to provide electricity for the town and the surrounding area, the first of four dams the Chinese have already built on the river they call the Lanzangjiang, or the Turbulent One. The biggest for now is at Manwan, several hundred miles downriver in southern Yunnan province, where the Turbulent One has been tamed. The Mekong here, above the massive Manwan Dam, is a 50-mile-long lake, not a river. And the power generated by the dam has helped fuel China's economic boom and the jobs that have come with it. And while environmentalists worry about the dam's effects on local communities and on fisheries downstream, boatman Chuhua Cho is having none of it.
I make a lot more money giving boat rides to tourists than I did as a farmer. Sure, some villages were destroyed when this place was flooded, but the people were compensated. Some complain it wasn't enough, but everyone has a different perspective, I guess. But for me, the dam has been a good thing.
Others who live along the river in Yunnan province aren't convinced. Mai Yan runs a small hotel not far from where the Mekong tumbles out of Tibet in a torrent. An area home to many ethnic minorities where the government is planning several more dams, she says, that may leave her town and several others in this valley underwater too. Like many here, she is uneasy with the prospect and uneasy with the influx of majority Han Chinese that development has brought. She is from the ethnic Bai minority, her father ethnic Hui and her husband ethnic Lisu.
Before, this village was mostly Bai, and that was a language spoken here. But now, the majority is Han, and the main language is Chinese. The older generation still speaks their own language, but for younger people like me, Our first language is Chinese.
A geologist working for a local mining company listens intently at a nearby table, then pulls me aside as we're checking out. He's ethnic Bai, too, and views the Han Chinese with suspicion. There are a lot more Han than the government says there are, he says, and more are moving here. The Chinese, he says softly, are dangerous. To whom, I ask? To the ethnic minorities, he says, and to our neighbors. A spirited card game on the dock at the Mekong River port of Guanlei. Fresh fruit, most of it apples, loaded onto Chinese riverboats bound for the markets of Bangkok and beyond. The trip down the Mekong to northern Thailand will take 10 hours or so, longer, a crew member says, if the boats have to wait for the dam upriver to release enough water to allow their heavily laden vessels to pass. Our captain eases his 100-foot-long boat downriver, where it quickly gathers speed in the swift current. The ship is too big, it seems, to sluice its way through the narrow and rock-strewn rapids here, where the river isn't much wider than our vessel. But the captain knows what he's doing, and where the river widens out, other boats pass us heading north, stacked high with timber and cars, feeding China's growing appetite for both.
Sunset on the Lansangjiang, heading downriver from Guanlei, China to Thailand. There's a light rain falling, sitting here on the stern, and a magnificent rainbow, which I take as an auspicious sign. On the left side of the river is Myanmar, the hills covered in a carpet of forest. On the right, for the next few minutes at least, it's still China. More than 1,000 miles from the source, the river is almost 3 times lower here in southern China than it was when it started, that tiny trickle high in the mountains. But even here, in southern China, the river is still more than 0.5 miles above sea level. Myanmar, Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam are all still ahead. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, on the Lansangjiang River, heading south.
Tomorrow, in part two of our series, the Lansangjiang becomes the Mekong River and carries us to a remote corner of Myanmar, where most people want nothing to do with the military government. All Things Considered continues in a moment.